The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you.
The Rocket by Ray Bradbury. Many nights, Lorello Bodini would awaken to hear the rocket sighing in the dark sky. He would tiptoe from bed, certain that his kind wife was dreaming, to let himself out into the night air. For a few moments, he would be free of the smells of old food in the small house by the river. For a silent moment, he would let his heart soar alone into space, following the rockets. Now, this very night, he stood half-naked in the darkness, watching the fire mountains murmuring in the air. The rockets on their long, wild way to Mars and Saturn and Venus. "Well, well, Bodini," Bodini started. On a milk crate by the silent river sat an old man who also watched the rockets through the midnight hush. "Oh, it's you, Bramante. Do you come out every night, Bodini?" "Only for the air." "So, I prefer the rockets myself," said old Bramante. "I was a boy when they started, 80 years ago, and I've never been on one yet." "I will ride up in one some day," said Bodini. "Fool," cried Bramante. "You'll never go. This is a rich man's world." He shook his gray head, remembering. "When I was young, they wrote it in fiery letters. The world of the future. Science, comfort, and new things for all. Ha! 80 years. The future becomes now. Do we fly rockets? No. We live in shacks like our ancestors before us." "Perhaps my sons," said Bodoni. "No, nor their sons," the old man shouted. "It's the rich who have dreams and rockets." Bodoni hesitated. "Old man, I've saved $3,000. It took me 6 years to save it. For my business, to invest in machinery. But every night for a month now I've been awake. I hear the rockets, I think. And tonight I've made up my mind. One of us will fly to Mars." His eyes were shining in dark. "Idiot," snapped Bramante. "How will you choose? Who will go? If you go, your wife will hate you, for you will be just a bit nearer God in space. When you tell her your amazing trip to her over the years, won't bitterness gnaw at her? No, no. Yes, and your children, will their lives be filled with the memory of Papa, who flew to Mars while they stayed here? What a senseless task you will set your boys. They will think of the rocket all their lives. They will lie awake. They will be sick with wanting it, just as you are sick now. They will want to die if they cannot go. Don't set that goal, I warn you. Let them be content with being poor. Turn their eyes down to their hands and to your junkyard, not up to the stars. But suppose your wife went. How would you feel, knowing she had seen and you had not? She would become holy. You would think of throwing her in the river. No, Bodoni. Buy a new wrecking machine, which you need, and pull your dreams apart with it and smash them to pieces." The old man subsided, gazing at the river in which drowned images of rockets burned down the sky. "Good night," said Bodoni. "Sleep well," said the other. When the toast jumped from its silver box, Bodoni almost screamed. The night had been sleepless. Among his nervous children, beside his mountainous wife, Bodoni had twisted and stared at nothing. Bramante was right. Better to invest the money. Why save it when only one of the family could ride the rocket, while the others remained to melt in frustration? Fiorello, eat your toast, said his wife Maria. My throat is shriveled, said Bodoni. The children rushed in, the three boys fighting over a toy rocket, the two girls carrying dolls, which duplicated the inhabitants of Mars, Venus, and Neptune, green mannequins with three yellow eyes and 12 fingers. I saw the Venus rocket, cried Paolo. It took off, whoosh, hissed Anatolo. Children, shouted Bodoni, hands to his ears. They stared at him. He seldom shouted. Bodoni arose. Listen, all of you, he said. I have enough money to take one of us on the Mars rocket. Everyone yelled. You understand, he asked, only one of us. Who? Me, cried the children. You, said Maria. You, said Bodoni to her. They all fell silent. The children reconsidered. Let Lorenzo go, he's oldest. Let Miriam go, she's a girl. Think what you would see, said Bodoni's wife to him, but her eyes were strange. Her voice shook. The meteors, like fish, the universe, the moon. Someone should go who could tell it well on returning. You have a way with words. Nonsense, so have you, he objected. Everyone trembled. Here, said Bodoni unhappily. From a broom he broke straws of various lengths. The short straw wins. He held out his tight fist. Choose. Solemnly each took its turn. Long straw. Long straw. Another. Long straw. The children finished. The room was quiet. Two straws remained. Bodoni felt his heart ache in him. Now, he whispered. Maria. She drew. The short straw, she said. Ah, sighed Lorenzo, half happy, half sad. Mama goes to Mars. Bodoni tried to smile. Congratulations, I will buy your ticket today. Wait, Fiorello. You can leave next week, he murmured. She saw the sad eyes of her children upon her with the smiles beneath their straight, large noses. She returned the straw slowly to her husband. I cannot go to Mars. But why not? I will be busy with another child. What? She would not look at him. It wouldn't do for me to travel in my condition. He took her elbow. Is this the truth? Draw again. Start over. Why didn't you tell me before? He said incredulously. I didn't remember. Maria, Maria, he whispered, patting her face. He turned to the children. Draw again. Paolo immediately drew the short straw. I go to Mars, he danced wildly. Thank you, Father. The other children edged away. That's swell, Paolo. Paolo stopped smiling to examine his parents and his brothers and sisters. I can go, can't I? He asked uncertainly. Yes. And you'll like me when I come back? Of course. Paolo studied the precious broom straw in his trembling hand and shook his head. He threw it away. I forgot. School starts. I can't go. Draw again. But no one would draw. A full sadness lay on them. None of us will go, said Lorenzo. That's best, said Maria. Bramante was right, said Bodoni. With his breakfast curdled within him, Fiorello Bodoni worked in his junkyard, ripping metal, melting it, pouring out usable ingots. His equipment flaked apart. Competition had kept him on the insane edge of poverty for 20 years. It was a very bad morning. In the afternoon, a man entered the junkyard and called up to Bodoni on his wrecking machine. "Hey, Bodoni, I got some metal for you." "What is it, Mr. Matthews?" asked Bodoni listlessly. "A rocket ship. What's wrong? Don't you want it?" "Yes, yes." He seized the man's arm and stopped, bewildered. "Of course," said Matthews. "It's only a mock-up, you know. When they plan a rocket, they build a full-scale model first of aluminum. You might make a small profit boiling her down. I'll let you have her for $2,000. Bodoni dropped his hand. "I haven't the money." "Sorry, thought I'd help you. Last time we talked, you said how everyone outbid you on junk. Thought I'd slip this to you on the QT. Well, I need new equipment. I saved money for that." "I understand. If I bought your rocket, I wouldn't even be able to melt it down. My aluminum furnace broke down last week." "Sure. I couldn't possibly use the rocket if I bought it from you." "I know." Bodoni blinked and shut his eyes. He opened them and looked at Mr. Matthews. "But I am a great fool. I will take my money from the bank and give it to you. But if you can't melt the rocket down..." "Deliver it," said Bodoni. "All right, if you say so. Tonight?" "Tonight," said Bodoni, "would be fine. Yes, I would like to have a rocket ship tonight." There was a moon. The rocket was white and big in the junkyard. It held the whiteness of the moon and the blueness of the stars. Bodoni looked at it and loved all of it. He wanted to pet it and lie against it, pressing it with his cheek, telling it all the secret wants of his heart. He stared up at it. "You are all mine," he said. "Even if you never move or spit fire and just sit there and rust for 50 years, you are mine." The rocket smelled of time and distance. It was like walking into a clock. It was finished with Swiss delicacy. One might wear it on one's watch fob. "I might even sleep here tonight," Bodoni whispered excitedly. He sat in the pilot seat. He touched a lever. He hummed in his shut mouth, his eyes closed. The humming grew louder, louder, higher, higher, wilder, stranger. More exhilarating, trembling in him and leaning him forward and pulling him in the ship in a roaring silence and in a kind of metal screaming, while his fists flew over the controls and his eyes shut and quivered, and the sound grew and grew until it was a fire, a strength, a lifting, and a pushing of power that threatened to tear him in half. He gasped. He hummed again and again and did not stop, for it could not be stopped. It could only go on, his eyes tighter, his heart furious. "Taking off," he screamed. "The jolting concussion, the thunder, the moon," he cried, eyes blind tight. "The meteors, the silent Russian volcanic light. Mars, oh yes, Mars, Mars." He fell back, exhausted and panting. His shaking hands came loose of the controls, and his head tilted wildly. He sat for a long time, breathing out and in, his heart slowing. Slowly, slowly, he opened his eyes. The junkyard was still there. He sat motionless. He looked at the heaped pile of metal for a minute, his eyes never leaving them. Then, leaping up, he kicked the levers. "Take off, bless you!" The ship was silent. "I'll show you," he cried. Out in the night air, stumbling, he started the fierce motor of his terrible wrecking machine and advanced upon the rocket. He maneuvered the massive weights into the moonlit sky. He readied his trembling hands to plunge the weights, to smash, to rip apart this insolently false dream, this silly thing for which he had paid his money, which would not move, which would not do his bidding. "I'll teach you," he shouted. But his hand stayed. The silver rocket lay in the light of the moon, and beyond the rocket stood the yellow lights of his home, a block away, burning warmly. He heard the family radio playing some distant music. He sat for half an hour considering the rocket and the house lights, and his eyes narrowed and grew wide. He stepped down from the wrecking machine and began to walk, and as he walked, he began to laugh, and when he reached the back door of his house, he took a deep breath and called, "Maria, Maria, start packing. We're going to Mars." "Oh, ah, I can't believe it. You will, you will." The children balanced in the windy yard under the glowing rocket, not touching it yet. They started to cry. Maria looked at her husband. "What have you done?" she said. "Taken our money for this? It will never fly." "It will fly," he said, looking at it. "Rocket ships cost millions. Have you millions?" "It will fly," he repeated steadily. "Now go to the house, all of you. I have phone calls to make, work to do. Tomorrow we leave. Tell no one. Understand? It's a secret." The children edged off from the rocket, stumbling. He saw their small, feverish faces in the house windows far away. Maria had not moved. "You have ruined us," she said. "Our money used for this thing, when it should have been spent on equipment." "You will see," he said. Without a word, she turned away. "God help me," he whispered, and started to work. Through the midnight hours, trucks arrived, packages were delivered, and Bodoni, smiling, exhausted his bank account. With blowtorch and metal stripping, he assaulted the rocket, added, took away, worked fiery magics and secret insults upon it. He bolted 9 ancient automobile motors into the rocket's empty engine room. Then he welded the engine room shut so none could see his hidden labor. At dawn, he entered the house. "Maria," he said, "I'm ready for breakfast." She would not speak to him. At sunset, he called to the children. "We're ready. Come on." The house was silent. "I've locked them in the closet," said Maria. "What do you mean?" he demanded. "You'll be killed in that rocket," she said. "What kind of rocket can you buy for $2,000? A bad one." "Listen to me, Maria. It will blow up anyway. You are no pilot." "Nevertheless, I can fly this ship. I have fixed it." "You have gone mad," she said. "Where is the key to the closet?" "I have it here." He put out his hand. "Give it to me." She handed it to him. "You will kill them." "No, no." "Yes, you will. I feel it." He stood before her. "You won't come along?" "I'll stay here," she said. "You will understand. You will see then," he said and smiled. He unlocked the door of the closet. "Come, children, follow your father." "Goodbye, goodbye, Maria. Goodbye, Mama." She stayed in the kitchen window, looking over at them, very straight and silent. At the door of the rocket, the father said, "Children, this is a swift rocket. We will be gone only a short while. You must come back to school and I to my business." He took each of their hands in turn. "Listen, this rocket is very old and will fly only one more journey. It will not fly again. This will be the one trip of your life. Keep your eyes wide." "Yes, Papa." "Listen, Keep your ears clean. Smell the smells of a rocket. Feel, remember. So when you return, you will talk all of it, all the rest of your lives. Yes, Papa. The ship was quiet as a stopped clock. The airlock hissed shut behind them. He strapped them all like tiny mummies into rubber hammocks. Ready? He called. Ready, all replied. Blast off. He jerked 10 switches. The rocket thuddered and leaped. The children danced in their hammocks, screaming, "We're moving! We're off! Look! Here comes the moon!" The moon dreamed by. Meteors broke into fireworks. Time flowed away in a serpentine of gas. The children shouted. Released from their hammocks hours later, they peered from the ports. "There's Earth! There's Mars!" The rocket dropped pink petals of fire while the hour's dial spun. The child's eyes dropped shut. At last they hung like drunken moths in their cocoon hammocks. "Good," whispered Bodini, alone. He tiptoed from the control room to stand for a long moment, fearful at the airlock door. He pressed a button. The airlock door swung wide. He stepped out into space. Into the inky sides of meteor and gaseous torch, into swift mileages and infinite dimensions? No, Bodini smiled. All about the quivering rocket lay the junkyard. Rusting, unchanged, there stood the padlocked junkyard gate. The little silent house by the river. The kitchen window lighted and the river going down to the same sea. And in the center of the junkyard, manufacturing a magic dream, lay the quivering, purring rocket, shaking and roaring, bouncing the netted children like flies in a web. Maria stood in the kitchen window. He waved to her and smiled. He could not see if she waved or not. A small wave, perhaps. A small smile. The sun was rising. Bodini withdrew hastily into the rocket. Silence. All still slept. He breathed easily. Tying himself into a hammock, he closed his eyes. To himself he prayed, "Oh, let nothing happen to the illusion in the next 6 days. Let all of space come and go, and red Mars come up under our ship, and the moons of Mars, and let there be no flaws in the color film. Let there be three dimensions. Let nothing go wrong with the hidden mirrors and screens that mold the fine illusion. Let time pass without crisis." He awoke. Red Mars floated near the rocket. "Papa!" The children thrashed to be free. Bodini looked and saw Red Mars, and it was good, and there was no flaw in it, and he was very happy. At sunset on the seventh day, the rocket stopped shuddering. "We are home," said Bodini. They walked across the junkyard from the open door of the rocket, their blood singing, their faces glowing. Perhaps they knew what he had done. Perhaps they guessed his wonderful magic trick. But if they knew, if they guessed, they never said. Now they only laughed and ran. "I have ham and eggs for all of you," said Maria at the kitchen door. "Mama, Mama, you should have come to see Mars, Mama, and meteors and everything." "Yes," she said. At bedtime, the children gathered before Bodini. "We want to thank you, Papa." "It was nothing." "We will remember it for always, Papa. We will never forget." Very late in the night, Bodini opened his eyes. He sensed that his wife was lying beside him, watching him. She did not move for a very long time, and then suddenly she kissed his cheeks and his forehead. "What's this?" he cried. "You're the best father in the world," she whispered. "Why?" "Now I see," she said. "I understand." She lay back and closed her eyes, holding his hand. "Is it a very lovely journey?" she asked. "Yes," he said. "Perhaps," she said, "perhaps some night you might take me on just a little trip, do you think?" "Just a little one, perhaps," he said. "Thank you," she said. "Good night." "Good night," said Fiorello Bodoni. Another Bradbury tale, this one called The Man. Captain Hart stood in the door of the Rocket. "Why don't they come?" he said. "Who knows?" said Martin, his lieutenant. "Do I know, Captain? What kind of a place is this, anyway?" The captain lighted a cigar. He tossed the match out into the glittering meadow. The grass started to burn. Martin moved to stamp it out with his boot. "No," ordered Captain Hart. "Let it burn. Maybe they'll come see what's happening then, the ignorant fools." Martin shrugged and withdrew his foot from the spreading fire. Captain Hart examined his watch. "An hour ago we landed here, and does the welcoming committee rush out with a brass band to shake our hands? No, indeed. Here we ride millions of miles through space, and the fine citizens of some silly town on some unknown planet ignore us." He snorted, tapping his watch. "Well, I'll just give them 5 more minutes, and then..." "And then what?" asked Martin, ever so politely, watching the captain's jowls shake. "We'll fly over their damn city again and scare the hell out of them." His voice grew quieter. "Do you think, Martin, maybe they didn't see me land?" "They saw us. They looked up as we flew over." "Then why aren't they running across the field? Are they hiding? Are they yellow?" Martin shook his head. "No. Take these binoculars, sir. See for yourself. Everybody's walking around. They're not frightened. They just don't seem to care." Captain Hart placed the binoculars to his tired eyes. Martin looked up and had time to observe the lines and grooves of irritation, tiredness, nervousness there. Hart looked a million years old. He never slept. He ate little and drove himself on, on. Now his mouth moved, aged and drear, but sharp under the held binoculars. "Really, Martin, I don't know why we bother. We build rockets, we go to all the trouble of crossing space, searching for them, and this is what we get? Neglect? Look at those idiots wander about in there. Don't they realize how big this is? The first space flight to touch their provincial land? How many times does that happen? Are they that blasé?" Martin didn't know. Captain Hart gave him the binoculars wearily. "Why do we do it, Martin? This space travel, I mean. Always on the go, always searching, our insides always tight, never any rest. Maybe we're looking for peace and quiet. Certainly there's none on Earth," said Martin. "No, there's not, is there?" Captain Hart was thoughtful. The fire damped down. "Not since Darwin, eh? Not since everything went by the board, everything we used to believe in, divine power and all that. And so you think maybe that's why we're going out to the stars, eh, Martin? Looking out for our lost souls, is that it? Trying to get away from the evil planet to a good one?" "Perhaps, sir. Certainly we're looking for something." Captain Hart cleared his throat and tightened back into sharpness. "Well, right now we're looking for the mayor of that city there. Run in. Tell them who we are. The first rocket expedition to Planet 43 in Star System 3. Captain Hart sends his salutations and desires to meet the mayor. On the double." "Yes, sir." Martin walked slowly across the meadow. "Hurry," snapped the captain. "Yes, sir." Martin trotted away. Then he walked again, smiling to himself. The captain had smoked 2 cigars before Martin returned. Martin stopped and looked up into the door of the rocket, swaying, seemingly unable to focus his eyes or think. "Well," snapped Hart, "what happened? Are they coming to welcome us?" "No." Martin had to lean dizzily against the ship. "Why not?" "It's not important," said Martin. "Give me a cigarette, please, Captain." His fingers groped blindly at the rising pack, for he was looking at the golden city and blinking. He lighted one and smoked quietly for a long time. "Say something," cried the captain. "Aren't they interested in our rocket?" Martin said, "What? The rocket?" He inspected his cigarette. "No, they're not interested. Seems we came at an inopportune time." "Inopportune time?" Martin was patient. "Captain, listen. Something big happened yesterday in that city. It's so big, so important, that we're second rate, second fiddle. I've got to sit down." He lost his balance and sat heavily, gasping for air. The captain chewed his cigar angrily. "What happened?" Martin lifted his head, smoke from the burning cigarette in his fingers blowing in the wind. "Sir, yesterday, in that city, a remarkable man appeared. Good, intelligent, compassionate, and infinitely wise." The captain glared at his lieutenant. "What's that to do with us?" "It's hard to explain, but he was a man for whom they'd waited a long time, a million years, maybe. And yesterday he walked into their city. That's why today, sir, our rocket landing means nothing." The captain sat down violently. "Who was it?" "Not Ashley. He didn't arrive in his rocket before us and steal my glory, did he?" He seized Martin's arm. His face was paled and dismayed. "Not Ashley, sir." "Then it was Burton. I knew it. Burton stole in ahead of us and raised my landing. He ruined it. You can't trust anyone anymore." "Not Burton either, sir," said Martin quietly. The captain was incredulous. "There were only three rockets. We were in the lead. This man who got here ahead of us, what was his name?" "He didn't have a name. He doesn't need one. It would be different on every planet, sir." The captain stared at his lieutenant with hard, cynical eyes. "Well, what did he do that was so wonderful that nobody even looked at our ship?" "For one thing," said Martin steadily, "he healed the sick and confirmed the poor and comforted the poor. He fought hypocrisy and dirty politics and sat among the people, talking through the day." "Is that so wonderful?" "Yes, Captain." "I don't get this." The captain confronted Martin, peered into his face and eyes. "You've been drinking, eh?" He was suspicious. He backed away. "I don't understand." Martin looked at the city. "Captain, if you don't understand, there's no way of telling you." The captain followed his gaze. The city was quiet and beautiful, and a great peace lay over it. The captain stepped forward, taking his cigar from his lips. He squinted first at Martin, then at the golden spires of the buildings. "You don't mean, you can't mean, the man you're talking about couldn't be." Martin nodded. "That's what I mean, sir." The captain stood silently, not moving. He drew himself up. "I don't believe it," he said at last. At high noon, Captain Hart walked briskly into the city, accompanied by Lieutenant Martin and an assistant who was carrying some electrical equipment. Every once in a while, the captain laughed loudly, put his hands on his hips, and shook his head. The mayor of the town confronted him. Martin set up a tripod, screwed a box onto it, and switched on the batteries. "Are you the mayor?" The captain jabbed a finger out. "I am," said the mayor. The delicate apparatus stood between them, controlled and adjusted by Martin and the assistant. Instantaneous translation from any language were made by the box. The words sounded crisply on the mild air of the city. "About this occurrence yesterday," said the captain. "It occurred?" "It did." "You have witnesses?" "We have." "May we talk to them?" "Talk to any of us," said the mayor. "We are all witnesses." In an aside to Martin, the captain said, "Mass hallucination?" To the mayor, "What did this man, this stranger, look like?" "That would be hard to say," said the mayor, smiling a little. "Why would it? Opinions might differ slightly." "I'd like your opinion, sir, anyway," said the captain. "Record this," he snapped to Martin over his shoulder. The lieutenant pressed the button of a hand recorder. "Well," said the mayor of the city, "he was a very gentle and kind man. He was of a great and knowing intelligence." "Yes, yes, I know, the captain waved his fingers. "Generalizations. I want something specific. What did he look like?" "I don't believe that is important," replied the mayor. "It's very important," said the captain sternly. I want a description of this fellow. If I can't get it from you, I'll get it from others. To Martin, I'm sure it must have been Burton pulling one of his practical jokes. Martin would not look him in the face. Martin was coldly silent. The captain snapped his fingers. There was something or other, a healing. Many healings, said the mayor. May I see one? You may, said the mayor. My son. He nodded at a small boy who stepped forward. He was afflicted with a withered arm. Now look upon it. At this the captain laughed tolerantly. Yes, yes, this isn't even circumstantial evidence, you know. I didn't see the boy's withered arm. I see only his own arm, whole and well. That's no proof. What proof have you that the boy's arm was withered yesterday and today is well? My word is my proof, said the mayor simply. My dear man, cried the captain, you don't expect me to go on hearsay, do you? Oh, no. I'm sorry, said the mayor, looking upon the captain with what appeared to be curiosity and pity. Do you have any pictures of the boy before today? Asked the captain. After a moment, a large oil portrait was carried forth, showing the son with a withered arm. My dear fellow, the captain waved it away, anybody can paint a picture. Paint lie. I want a photograph of this boy. There was no photograph. Photography was not a known art in their society. Well, sighed the captain, face twitching. Let me talk to a few other citizens. We're getting nowhere. He pointed at a woman. You, she hesitated. Yes, you, come here, ordered the captain. Tell me about this wonderful man you saw yesterday. The woman looked steadily at the captain. He walked among us and was very fine and good. What color were his eyes? The color of the sun, the color of the sea. The color of a flower, the color of the mountains, the color of the night. That'll do, the captain threw up his hands. See, Martin, absolutely nothing. Some charlatan wanders through, whispering sweet nothings in their ears, and please stop it, said Martin. The captain stepped back. What? You heard what I said, said Martin. I like these people. I believe what they say. You're entitled to your opinion, but keep it to yourself, sir. You can't talk to me this way, shouted the captain. I've had enough of your high-handedness, replied Martin. Leave these people alone. They've got something good and decent, and you come and foul up the nest and sneer at it. Well, I've talked to them, too. I've gone through the city and seen their faces, and they've got something you'll never have, a little simple faith, and they'll move mountains with it. You're boiled because someone stole your act, got here ahead, and made you unimportant. I'll give you 5 seconds to finish, remarked the captain. I understand. You've been under a strain, Martin. Months of traveling in space, nostalgia, loneliness, and now, with this thing happening, I sympathize, Martin. I overlook your petty insubordination. I don't overlook your petty tyranny, replied Martin. I'm stepping out. I'm staying here. You can't do that, can't I? Try and stop me. This is what I came looking for. I didn't know it, but this is it. This is for me. Take your filth somewhere else and foul up other nests with your doubt and your scientific method. He looked quite swiftly about. These people have had an experience, and you can't seem to get it through your head that it's really happened, and we were lucky enough to almost arrive in time to be on it. People on Earth have talked about this man for 20 centuries, after he walked through the old world. We all wanted to see him and hear him and never had the chance. And now, today, we just missed seeing him by a few hours. Captain Hart looked at Martin's cheeks. You're crying like a baby. Stop it. I don't care. Well, I do. In front of these natives, we're to keep up a front. You're never overwrought, as I said. I forgive you. I don't want your forgiveness. You idiot, can't you see this is one of Burton's tricks? To fool these people, to bilk them, to establish his oil and mineral concerns under a religious... Guise, you fool, Martin, you absolute fool. You should know Earthmen by now. They'll do anything. Blaspheme, lie, cheat, steal, kill, to get their ends. Anything is fine if it works. The true pragmatist, that's Burton, you know him. The captain scoffed heavily. Come off it, Martin, admit it. This is the sort of scaly thing Burton might carry off. Polish up these citizens and pluck them when they're ripe. No, said Martin, thinking of it. The captain put his hands up. That's Burton. That's him. That's his dirt. That's his criminal way. I have to admire the old dragon, flaming in here in a blaze and a halo and a soft word and a loving touch, with a medicated salve here and there, healing ray there. That's Burton, all right. No, Martin's voice was dazed. He covered his eyes. No, I won't believe it. You don't want to believe, Captain Hart kept at it. Admit it now, admit it. It's just the thing Burton would do. Stop daydreaming, Martin. Wake up. It's morning. This is a real world, and we're real dirty people. Burton, the dirtiest of us all. Martin turned away. There, there, Martin, said Hart, mechanically patting the man's back. I understand. Quite a shock for you, I know. A rotten shame and all that. But Burton is a rascal. You go take it easy. Let me handle this. Martin walked off slowly toward the rocket. Captain Hart watched him go. Then, taking a deep breath, he turned to the woman he'd been questioning. Well, tell me some more about this man. As you were saying, madam? Later, the officers of the rocket ship ate supper on card tables outside. The captain correlated his data to a silent Martin who sat red-eyed and brooding over his meal. Interviewed 36 people. All of them full of the same milk and hogwash, said the captain. It's Burton's work, all right, I'm positive. He'll be spilling back in here tomorrow or next week to consolidate his miracles and beat us out in our contracts. I think I'll stick on and spoil it for him. Martin glanced up sullenly. I'll kill him, he said. Now, now, Martin, there, there, boy. I'll kill him, so help me, I will. We'll put an anchor on his wagon. You have to admit he's clever. Unethical, but clever. He's dirty. You must promise not to do anything violent, Captain Hart checked his figures. According to this, there were 30 miracles of healing performed, a blind man restored to vision, a leper cured. Oh, Burton's efficient. Give him that. A gong sounded. A moment later, a man ran up. Captain, sir, a report. Burton's ship is coming down. Also, the Ashley ship, sir. See? Captain Hart beat the table. Here come the jackals to the harvest. They can't wait to feed. Wait till I confront them. I'll make them cut me in on this feast. I will. Martin looked sick. He stared at the captain. Business, my dear boy, business, said the captain. Everybody looked up. Two rockets swung down out of the sky. When the rockets landed, they almost crashed. What's wrong with those fools? Cried the captain, jumping up. The men ran across the meadowlands to the steaming ships. The captain arrived. The airlock door popped open on Burton's ship. A man fell out into their arms. What's wrong? Cried Hart. The man lay on the ground. They bent over him, and he was burned, badly burned. His body was covered with wounds and scars and tissues that was inflamed and smoking. He looked up out of puffed eyes, and his thick tongue moved in his split lips. What happened? Demanded the captain, kneeling down, shaking the man's arm. Sir, sir, whispered the dying man. 48 hours ago, back in Space Sector 79 DPS, off Planet 1 in this system, our ship, an Ashley ship, ran into a cosmic storm, sir. Liquid ran gray from the man's nostrils. Blood trickled from his mouth. Wiped out all crew. Burton dead. Ashley died an hour ago. Only 3 survived. Listen to me, shouted Hart, bending over the bleeding man. You didn't come to this planet before this very hour? Silence. Answer me, cried Hart. The dying man said, no. Storm. Burton dead 2 days ago. This first landing on any world in 6 months. Are you sure? Shouted Hart, shaking violently, gripping the man in his hands. Are you sure? Sure, sure, mouthed the dying man. Burton died 2 days ago, you're positive? Yes, yes, whispered the man. His head fell forward. The man was dead. The captain knelt beside the silent body. The captain's face twitched, the muscles jerking involuntarily. The other members of the crew stood back of him, looking down. Martin waited. The captain asked to be helped to his feet, finally, and this was done. They stood looking at the city. That means, said Martin. We're the only ones who've been here, whispered Captain Hart. And that man. What about that man, Captain? Asked Martin. The captain's face twitched senselessly. He looked very old, indeed, and gray. His eyes were glazed. He moved forward in the dry grass. "Come along, Martin. Come along. Hold me up, for my sake, hold me. I'm afraid I'll fall, and hurry. We can't waste time." They moved, stumbling toward the city in the long, dry grass, in the blowing wind. Several hours later, they were sitting in the mayor's auditorium. 1,000 people had come and talked and gone. The captain had remained seated, his face haggard, listening, listening. There was so much light in the faces of those who came and testified and talked, he could not bear to see them. And all the while his hands traveled, on his knees, together, on his belt, jerking and quivering. When it was over, Captain Hart turned to the mayor and with strange eyes said, "But you must know where he went." "He didn't say where he was going," replied the mayor. "To one of the other nearby worlds?" demanded the captain. "I don't know." "You must know." "Do you see him?" asked the mayor, indicating the crowd. The captain looked. "No." "Then he is probably gone," said the mayor. "Probably, probably," cried the captain weakly. "I've made a horrible mistake, and I want to see him now. Why, it just came to me. This is a most unusual thing in history, to be in on something like this. Why, the chances are one in billions we'd arrived at one certain planet among millions of planets the day after he came. You must know where he's gone." "Each finds him in his own way," replied the mayor gently. "You're hiding him." The captain's face grew slowly ugly. Some of the old hardness returned in stages. He began to stand up. "No," said the mayor. "You know where he is, then?" The captain's fingers twitched at the leather holster on his right side. "I couldn't tell you where he is, exactly," said the mayor. "I advise you to start talking," said the captain, took out a small steel gun. "There's no way," said the mayor, "to tell you anything." "Liar!" An expression of pity came into the mayor's face as he looked at Hart. "You're very tired," he said. "You traveled a long way, and you belong to a tired people who've been without faith a long time, and you want to believe so much now that you're interfering with yourself. You'll only make it harder if you kill. You'll never find him that way." "Where'd he go?" "He told you. You know. Come on, tell me." The captain waved the gun. The mayor shook his head. "Tell me, tell me." The gun cracked once, twice. The mayor fell, his arm wounded. Martin leaned forward. "Captain!" The gun flashed at Martin. "Don't interfere." On the floor, holding his wounded arm, the mayor looked up. "Put down your gun. You're hurting yourself. You've never believed, and now that you think you believe, you hurt the people because of it." "I don't need you," said Hart, standing over him. "If I missed him by one day here, I'll go on to another world, and another, and another. I'll miss him by half a day on the next planet, maybe, and a quarter of a day on the third planet, and 2 hours on the next, and an hour on the next, and half an hour on the next, and a minute on the next. But after that, one day I'll catch up with him. Do you hear that?" He was shouting now, leaning wearily over the man on the floor. He staggered with exhaustion. "Come along, Martin." He let the gun hang in his hand. "No," said Martin. "I'm staying here." "You're a fool. Stay if you like, but I'm going on with the others as far as I can go." The mayor looked up at Martin. "I'll be all right. Leave me. Others will tend my wounds." "I'll be back," said Martin. "I'll walk as far as the rocket." They walked with vicious speed through the city. One could see with what effort the captain struggled to show all the old iron to keep himself going. When he reached the rocket, he slapped the side of it. With a trembling hand, he holstered his gun. He looked at Martin. "Well, Martin?" Martin looked at him. "Well, Captain?" The captain's eyes were on the sky. "Sure you won't come with me, eh?" "No, sir." "It'll be a great adventure, by God. I know I'll find him." "You are set on it now, aren't you, sir?" asked Martin. The captain's face quivered and his eyes closed. "Yes. There's one thing I'd like to know." "What?" "Sir, when you find him, if you find him," asked Martin, "what will you ask of him?" "Why?" The captain faltered, opening his eyes, his hands clenched and unclenched. He puzzled a moment and then broke into a strange smile. "Why, I'll ask him for a little peace and quiet." He touched the rocket. "It's been a long time, a long, long time since I relaxed." "Did you ever just try, Captain?" "I don't understand," said Hart. "Never mind. So long, Captain." "Goodbye, Mr. Martin." The crew stood by the port. Out of their number, only three were going off with Hart. Seven others were remaining behind, they said, with Martin. Captain Hart surveyed them and uttered his verdict. Fools. He, last of all, climbed into this airlock, gave a brief salute. Laughed sharply. The door slammed. The rocket lifted into the sky on a pillar of fire. Martin watched it go far away and vanish. At the meadow's edge, the mayor, supported by several men, beckoned. "He's gone," said Martin, walking up. "Yes, poor man, he's gone," said the mayor. "And he'll go on, planet after planet, seeking and seeking, and always he will be an hour late or a half hour late or 10 minutes late or a minute late, and finally he will miss out by only a few seconds. And when he has visited 300 worlds and is 70 or 80 years old, he will miss out by only a fraction of a second, and then a smaller fraction of a second, and he will go on and on, thinking to find that very thing which he left behind here on this planet, in this city." Martin looked steadily at the mayor. The mayor put out his hand. "Was there ever any doubt of it?" He beckoned to the others and turned. "Come along now. We mustn't keep him waiting." They walked into the city.